Hi, I'm Charmaine Matlock-Turner, President and CEO of the Urban Affairs Coalition, and you're listening to Driving Change. To say 2020 has been a challenging time for the country would be an understatement. From COVID-19 disrupting life as we knew it, to millions taking to the streets in the middle of a health pandemic, putting their health at risk, to call for an end to racism, discrimination, marginalization, and hate. The Urban Affairs Coalition was founded after the tragic assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Community, government, and business leaders came together to better understand how we could work together to change from where we stand as a community and a people. Many of us had experienced the civil unrest of 1964 in our city and hoped to stem that tide of unrest in 1968. Over the last 52 years, we have continued to fight for those who are Black, Brown, and poor by reminding all of us, including government, business, community, and individuals, that we must come together as a city and respond to the needs of those that have the least. I would argue that we need to look deep within ourselves and look past the easy answers. We must ask ourselves the tougher questions. How do we end this nightmare? Why, after all these years, have we not made more progress? My hope is that the conversations and our series in this podcast will help us drive enough change to make sure that this becomes a movement and not just a moment in history. So let's talk, let's think, let's listen. Most importantly, let's recommit to the humanity in all of us and act decisively to make those in greatest need our number one priority. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to a man, and I won't say introduce because most of you will know him, who helped shape and pave the way for what the coalition is today. My friend, my mentor, and the former UAC president and CEO, Mr. Ernest Jones Esquire. Hi, Ernie.
Hi, Charmaine. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Ernie, your passion for your work is personal, I know, and goes back to your childhood. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about you and your journey and how you ended up as president of the coalition and how that still inspires you today?
Wow, that's
that's a lot, right?
Well, and taking it back many, many years. I was born in Georgia, Savannah, Georgia, and my family, like many other Black families in the 50s, migrated from the South to the North. We came here, and my grandmother was up here, so she was sort of the center of our relocation. We moved to North Philadelphia. I lived at first with her on Ringgold Street in the 1800 block. And then my family bought a house on 24th Street between Montgomery and Berks. The address is 1819 North 24th Street. I remember it.
Never forget those addresses.
You never do, right. Went to public schools in Philadelphia. Went to Douglas Singling. Then Vaux was a junior high school. Vaux. And then went to Ben Franklin High School. Throughout all of my educational experiences, I was really blessed with having good teachers. Actually, until I went to high school, they were all African-American, but they cared and they inspired me and encouraged me. And when I did something wrong, they punished me, just kept me moving in the right direction. When I graduated from Ben Franklin High School, the schools I knew of or had heard of were historically the Black colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. I had my eye on Howard University and perhaps Hampton. My counselor at the time, Mrs. Payton, and Mrs. Carson, actually there were two of them, said to me, you really ought to consider broadening your horizon in terms of colleges. And at the time, I graduated in 62. There was a push in some schools to recruit minority students. And I was the beneficiary of that movement. My counselor suggested to me that you might want to consider a small liberal arts school. I applied to and was accepted both at Dickinson College, which is in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and Swarthmore, which is right outside of Philadelphia. I was accepted at both, but for a number of reasons, which I won't go into today, decided to attend Dickinson College. That was an eye-opening experience for me. There were 10 Blacks in the entire school.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how many Black students? Okay, 10.
And I played football. I can recall going up there before school actually started. My parents dropped me off. Here I am, this lonely kid amongst a sea of white students. I remember that first night I'd missed dinner, went downtown to order a hoagie, and they looked at me like I was speaking a foreign language, like, what the hell is a hoagie? So I learned then that there were subs. But I was very fortunate, again, in that it was a time when most of the people there were welcoming to this notion of bringing in diversity and minorities to school, even though they only had 10. And I think prior to that, may have had just 2 in the entire school for a number of years. I was, I would say, quote, accepted, treated fairly, and overall had a good 4-year experience. I did get kicked out at one point because of a racial incident that took place in a bar. I shouldn't have been in a bar, but was downtown, and there was a big fight. And to be honest with you, some of my white friends came to my support, and we went back down and had a big fight. One of the guys, one of the townies, as we call them, was injured seriously, and it led to my being charged with disorderly conduct with, no, I'm sorry, at first it was assault and battery with the intent to kill. And, and I was kicked out, but then it sort of blew up into a bigger incident. The guy who actually hit him in the head with the bottle, another white guy from Dickinson, came forward and said, no, he did it. The charges were subsequently reduced to disorderly conduct. The guy didn't die, incidentally. He survived. And we moved on from there. If you want to stop me at any point, if I'm rambling too much, let me know.
No. I was going to say, so with that experience, were you able to get back into Dickinson and actually complete your undergraduate work there?
Yes, that is true. I mean, I initially was suspended for a semester, but the school changed their mind, and it was a 2-week suspension. I came back, and then, you know, everything else was fine. I was also in the Reserve Officers Training Corps, ROTC. And so upon graduation, I was commissioned a second lieutenant in the Army. Came home, I worked for 6 months as a social worker here in the city, went on active duty, and I was very fortunate again. My life is a series of blessings. It's just amazing. Went on active duty, I was an infantry second lieutenant, and at the time, they were really building up all of the units to ship to Vietnam. Out of my battalion down in Fort Benning, only 4 of us were sent to places other than Vietnam, and I was one of those. I spent 2 years over in Korea, up on the zone, and there were little skirmishes there, but you know, nothing too major, nothing like Vietnam. Decided there I wanted to go to law school when I came back.
So I was going to ask you, so what inspired you to go to law school? Was it that incident that occurred when you were in college? Was it someone else that you saw? I mean, what was it? Was there someone else in your family, or had you heard a story of a lawyer? Like, what made you say, okay, I want to be a lawyer?
None of the above.
Okay.
Let me just say, it's really weird. And again, I'm looking at life in general. Things happen to people, and you know, there's a path for, I think everybody takes, and stuff happens. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can control it. Other times you don't. It just happens. I decided I wanted to go to law school. I was sitting on a mountaintop. This is the honest to God truth, overlooking the Yellow Sea, saying, what are you going to do when you get back to the States? And I said, I'll go to law school. One of the things that Dickinson required was in your senior year, you either took the LSAT, the law school admission test, or the GRE, the graduate record exam, and I decided to take the LSAT. But came back and applied to Temple and was accepted. Actually met Peter Leocouris. He was the one who called me up and urged me to come to Temple. Again, this was at the time when Peter and others were trying to expand the number of minorities in the law school. Peter went out and recruited all over the country. Got my good friend Nelson Diaz in the class. Carl Sengley was in the class. Mm-hmm. Dottie Moore, other. We had in that particular class, I think 10, 12 African Americans, which was unheard of at Temple Law School. Up to that point, there were like 2 admitted a year. You know, I went to law school. Again, at that time, I didn't have within me this burning desire to fix the world or to conquer anything. something happened. I think it was in my end of my first year. There was a brother in Chicago, Fred Hampton, who was a member of the Black Panther Party.
Panthers, yes.
You know, after getting out of the military, I started to read a lot more. And I started to follow the Black Panthers. When he was assassinated by the police in Chicago, it did something to me. Not only did I go out and I joined the Black Panthers, but it really sort of got me to thinking about justice in life, about the correct way of living life, about the injustices that we primarily African-Americans face day in and day out. And it was at that point I really sort of decided I should be part of this, part of fighting the injustices, the inequalities that exist in this country. So I sort of dedicated myself from that point on to working and talking and doing whatever I could to help deal with some of these issues. So that, I mean, if you're looking for a way or a point in my life that sort of steered me in one direction, I would say that was the event that did it for me.
And I can certainly understand that. That was a very tragic time. And unfortunately, we're looking at some of that same kind of time right now for really the next generation. Hopefully, there'll be many young people who will be inspired to dedicate their lives to change. So in sort of doing that earning, I know you went on to work for community legal services and, you know, work for those who were really in need of good legal representation. But from there, you ended up at this organization called the Urban Coalition. How did that happen?
Well, I was at CLS. I'd been there for about 5 or 6 years. And during the time, most of the time, Charlie Bowser was the president of then the Philadelphia Urban Coalition. Charlie left to run for mayor.
I worked on his campaign.
Okay.
Yeah. I was his office manager, by the way, in a little office on Walnut Street, which we call the half floor. That was my office.
All right. Well, good. You were there making history. Charlie's brother, John, became the president of the coalition. Now, whereas Charlie was more of an activist, a politician, someone who really wanted to stir things up, John was basically a businessman. And so he came in and actually instituted a number of programs at the coalition while he was there to promote minority businesses. But then John got this idea that he wanted to redo the Uptown Theater.
Yes.
And created the new Uptown Theater, New Tech is what we used to call it.
Yes.
So
yes, yes, yes.
He got really caught up into that to the point where he decided that he really couldn't do it the way he wanted to do it while and still serve as the head of the Urban Coalition. So he left. He left to devote his energies full time to New Tech. I had known Charlie over the years, not real well, but you know, certainly he was someone I admired. Being a lawyer, we interacted in that arena. Charlie called me up one day and said, "John's leaving. Would you be interested in coming to the Urban Coalition?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, let me think about it." And I did. And he said, "Well, you know, send me your resume, a letter of interest," and he would pass it on to the board. And he did. There was a search committee. I went through a whole process being interviewed, and I was very lucky in that they chose me in the end to become the, then it was executive director. We mm-hmm. sort of changed it over the years. It was a good move. I mean, on my part, personally, I got paid more.
And that's always good.
Legal services lawyers don't pay. Even today, they don't get paid what they should get paid. It really opened up, not only was open up things for me, not just personally, but it expanded my view of the world. I mean, I got to, for the very first time in my life, interact with business leaders. You know, as a little kid in North Philadelphia, you don't come downtown to interact with the people in the boardrooms. But this position gave me that opportunity. And it also gave me the opportunity to go back into the community and to try to do some good. You know, we started out, one of the core functions of the coalition was to make grants to community-based organizations. Mm-hmm. And that was, we were primarily known for that initially. We collected money annually from businesses. We had a whole granting process, gave out money. And as a result, we had very, very extensive interactions with community leaders, community organizations, And I think it really helped the city, you know, in a number of different ways. But that was one of the core functions. And as the time went on, we expanded the activities to include more business development. We really made, we made our mark in the area of the construction industry. Mm-hmm. We were very fortunate in having someone like Charlie Solomon and Jim Roundtree and Frank Sims, those guys who knew the industry, to run this for the coalition. And I remember my very first big project was the construction of the Temple University Hospital. Mm-hmm. Turner Construction Company, we set all sorts of records in doing that. And following that, the coalition became known as the entity. If you wanted to get something done in terms of involving women-owned and minority-owned construction companies, you need to go to the Urban Coalition. And of course,
you also, though, sort of expanded it into the building trades, which had been very, very difficult to try to break into. So you're trying to get the business side done, and you're also trying to get the employment side done.
Absolutely. In fact, I was looking at some of the old annual reports, and you know, a couple of them we dedicated almost exclusively to the trades, the building trades, and the people we were able to get jobs. You know, for what electricians, plumbers, carpenters, mm-hmm. cement finishers, you name it. We ran programs that trained them and got them placed in the building trades.
And Ernie, I would also add that not only, you know, was it the work that was done, but really I think your legal background and your connection to Temple and Carl, where you created after the Bakke decision, a way for this program to be successful and for it not to be seen as a quota program. Can you just talk about that a little bit? Because I've always been fascinated by that story.
Again, we're very fortunate because we developed this reputation of, you know, the go-to organization in this area. When the Pennsylvania Convention Center was about to be built, and my good friend Dwight Evans was very instrumental in pushing it, said that he wanted to have, and then we called it an affirmative action plan for the convention center. Now, up to that point, and after the Bakke decision, set fixed quotas. The Supreme Court said that that's illegal. That's unconstitutional. So we had to develop a plan, and we did. Actually, I might still have my yellow paper that I was scratching out and
draft the
affirmative action plan. But we developed this concept of meaningful and substantial involvement of minorities and women and making your best efforts to achieve that. And that's a little nebulous, and it really requires that people act in good faith. But it gave us some guidance and some plan for involving minorities and women in the construction. And that was challenged by the building trades and by some of the contractors. And the courts upheld it, basically said it did not violate Bakke. And the Pennsylvania Convention Center could use that going forward. And we did.
And that's been the basis for that work ever since. I mean, yes. That decision was key to Philadelphia having this program and for it still to be going on. I think it's the first time we've sort of like almost had like not a lot to do because we're in the middle of a pandemic and a lot of the construction work has been slowed down. But we still are contacted and reached out to help major organizations build and rebuild in the city of Philadelphia. So, you know, your work there was just absolutely still continuing, and we're hoping to continue to see it grow.
Well, kudos to you on that. I just want to say kudos to you because you've expanded it. I mean, you've got people, and you know, you look around Philadelphia and all these skyscrapers, the Comcast Center, the mm-hmm. First and the Technology Center, all of those things, the Urban Affairs Coalition played an integral part and making sure that there was representation of minorities and women in the construction of those buildings. And it's a testament to you and to the coalition, and has brought lots of benefits to the city.
Thank you, Ernie. Yes, it really has. And we still know that we've made really great progress, but I tell people, we never sort of rest on our laurels. We are always pushing harder to try to get more, opportunity, because as you know, we still have too many people in our city who are poor and are still trying to find that way to a better life. So Ernie, I know we don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to get a sense from you about, you know, we're also in the middle of, you know, what I'm calling hopefully a movement and not a moment where we're seeing issues of racism and marginalization again be a part of the main conversation. I remember, I think, when President Obama was elected, a lot of people said, okay, the race problem in America has been solved, so we don't need to talk about it anymore. Does this feel like a movement to you right now, or does it just feel like, okay, something's bubbled up, but maybe it won't create lasting change?
You know, actually, based on my history in the past, I initially was inclined to think of it as a moment as opposed to a movement. But the more I think about it and the more I see who's involved in this, I see it more now as a movement rather than a moment. Young people, I mean, it's their world, and they're the ones who are going to dictate what happens down the line. Granted, old timers like me look at things slightly different. Sometimes we don't agree with either the methods that are being taken, but the bottom line is I really believe the younger generation is ready for a change, a significant change. You know, and the fact that this is a multiracial movement, it's not just African Americans. Across the board, from Native Americans to Asians, African Americans, whites, everybody is saying we've got to be different today. And if enough people say that and believe it, it's going to happen. It really will. I may not be around to see it, but it will happen. I certainly hope it happens sooner than later.
Right. I'm with you. I definitely agree with you. When I saw how deep it was and how intergenerational and how many young people and then how many different groups, that it wasn't just the cry of African Americans as the victims of this, but really the broader society saying, okay, we've had enough of this. This is absolutely ridiculous. We have got to try to fix it. And how we fix it is always going to be hard. We know we have work to do around policing and the history of policing and how we can change that. We know we've got economic issues that we have to deal with. We know that education is going to be key to this, but it does feel as if it's possible. And hopefully the coalition can continue to be a part of making sure that it absolutely is a movement. So Ernie, and just sort of wrapping things up, I have two questions that I have to ask you. And I think you might have answered this a little bit, but feel free to sort of like weigh in on it again. And you had some wonderful moments in your life, but if you sort of picked, like, what was the moment in your life that said that you are a dreamer and a doer? What moment would you pick?
That is a difficult, it's difficult to point to one thing that happened. But perhaps when I graduated from high school, again, like I said, I've been blessed with a lot of encouragement, with a lot of assistance. And I know I got scholarships, I got help, I got guidance as to where I should go. I think at that point, I started to dream. I thought that, you know, given what I, a poor boy from Georgia, had gotten to this point, the future looked bright for me. And I was, you know, happy. I was looking forward to it. And I would say probably at that stage of my life was when I really started to dream big dreams.
That's terrific, Ernie. So the next question is, and I know we've probably talked about this a little bit too, but feel free to share something you already have or something that's new. But like, I mean, there's so many great things that you've done in your life. We talked about the construction area. But what would you say is your biggest driving change moment? Like, what do you really want people to remember about what you did and how it impacted the broader community?
My grandkids.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Well, that's the subject of another discussion. You know, I like to think that, I mean, I care for people. I love my people. And if I wanted people to remember me for something, it's that I cared about people and I wanted to do things that would help them. Simple as that. And, you know, being a part of the coalition was certainly a big part of that and helped me to achieve that. And so I've, you know, lived my life with that underlying, or not so much underlying, but just out there premise. And that is that if you can help somebody, help them, life will be good for you.
Sounds like a good gospel song I've heard somewhere along the way. But Ernie, that's about all the time that we have for today. But this was so fascinating. And I thought I knew everything about you. And I learned a lot of new information today. So this has been wonderful. I can't wait to share it with the broader community. So again, thanks for joining us. Thanks for everything that you do. Thanks for continuing to contribute to UAC and really being a part of it. We're excited that we have an award named after you, and we really appreciate everything that you've done in the community and have remained absolutely committed to that. So again, I want to thank everybody for joining Driving Change with Charmaine Matlock-Turner today, and please keep listening for more interviews with some of the most fascinating people in our community.